Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama is on his last big trip overseas, reassuring European leaders and more that America will remain a strong and steady global presence against the backdrop of an election that stunned the world. Donald Trump appears less certain about America's particular global role now. Things, his traditional role maybe, things have to change, he says. He calls it America first, less globalization, more nationalism. It's a big deal with far-reaching implications. This hour on Point, President-elect Donald Trump's America First doctrine and what it may mean for the world. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the change you see coming on the global stage? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Getting ready for his trip abroad, President Obama said in his press conference on Monday that he had met with Donald Trump, that President-elect Trump had expressed a great interest in maintaining our core strategic relationships, including the one with NATO.
One of the most important functions I can serve at this stage during this trip is to let them know that there is no weakening of resolve when it comes to America's commitment to maintaining a strong and robust NATO relationship, and a recognition that those alliances aren't just good for Europe, they're good for the United States, and they're vital for the world.
But the president got to Europe, to Greece, arrived in Greece on Tuesday, had a joint press conference there with Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, and warned against populist movements spreading across the world, maybe a kind of brushback at his own successor, President-elect Donald Trump.
We are going to have to guard against a rise in a crude sort of nationalism or ethnic identity or tribalism that is built around an us and a them.
Let's go to Greece. Joining us from Athens is Margaret Brennan, foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News, who is traveling with the president. Margaret, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
What is the first question on the minds of European leaders as President Obama makes this visit?
Will Donald Trump's actions match his rhetoric on the campaign trail? That is the chief concern in a very rattled Europe, here in Greece and next in Germany, where their chief diplomat called Donald Trump a preacher of hate. That from a key U.S. ally. So what America is talking about on the campaign trail doesn't stay within our own borders. It reflects back to the rest of the world and projects an image of a very divided America. And as one diplomat said to me, a divided America is a divided world. And President Obama has his work cut out for him trying to calm these nerves.
When it comes to President-elect Trump's campaign rhetoric, what is it that has Europe most concerned?
Well, a number of things, specifically his questioning of NATO and the military alliances that the United States has, a commitment to defend Europe. Remember that the only time that NATO's Article 5, that clause that says an attack on one is an attack on all, the only time that's ever been used was after the attacks on the United States after 9/11. So this is an alliance that many will remind the president-elect is not only useful for Europe, but it is central to the defense of the United States and its own security. They're very concerned as well about this outreach to Russia and Vladimir Putin. Yes, President Obama tried to reset relations as well, but this idea that Donald Trump has said that he would question whether or not it's illegal for Putin to have annexed territory in Ukraine, where he has talked about Assad, the brutal dictator in Syria that the U.S. has been helping rebels to try to oust, that his support from Russia perhaps is justified because it's aimed at terrorism rather than just wiping out moderate opposition. These are the kind of things that really worry Europeans because they want to be able to count on the United States to defend their borders, to push back against Russia, and also stay committed to some of the global deals that European allies have helped the United States to hammer out, specifically the climate change agreement to cut back on greenhouse gases, and even more central, the Iran nuclear deal, which has frozen Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting sanctions. Donald Trump has said he's going to tear it up. That really worries leaders.
Margaret, look ahead, if you would, to the president's visit to Peru. Now, we've got a lot more to come in Europe. He'll sit down with Angela Merkel. That's a big deal. They've been very close, but he's headed on to Peru, which, of course, faces the Pacific, and there he will meet with Asian leaders. What's at the top of their list of questions for the outgoing president?
You know, this was supposed to be a farewell tour for President Obama, and it's become somewhat of just an explanation again and again and again, trying to calm nerves. And it's going to be the same one in Asia. What's even more difficult there is when President Obama meets with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. China and attacking China through rhetoric on the campaign trail was central to Donald Trump's foreign policy platform, to the degree that he gave any detail. Remember, he talked about putting trade tariffs on there, possibly launching a trade war, labeling China a currency manipulator. With China, the diplomacy is so delicate right now because they already are in sort of a position of discomfort with the United States, given the cyber attacks, given the U.S. concern that they're not cracking down on North Korea enough. The next president-elect has been threatening China, the country that the U.S. is relying on to rein in North Korea. So this is going to be a very difficult conversation for President Obama. And while he doesn't have a scheduled meeting with Vladimir Putin in Lima, Putin's going to be at that meeting. And U.S. officials acknowledge they very well may run into each other in the hallway, speak on the sidelines of the conference, as they often do. And what is that message right now? Because certainly the U.S. calls for Russia to stop the airstrikes in Syria that are killing civilians in Aleppo. President Obama doesn't have much leverage, not only because his time in office is running out, but because his successor has said he's going to perhaps join alliances with Vladimir Putin,
something
that Republicans in Congress have opposed.
Margaret, there is a ton of attention being paid right now back in the United States to the Trump budding administration's efforts to put together its foreign policy team and the difficulty they're having with that right now. Are foreign leaders watching that? How much difference does that make to them in terms of what they expect from President Trump, his administration?
Oh, absolutely. They're watching it so carefully. And honestly, it's interesting because just over the course of the past few days, I've heard so many different things from diplomats. At the beginning of the week, particularly from Arab diplomats, key allies of the United States, they were feeling reassured that the Trump team had actually made some really positive sentiments, positive messages sent, saying we really want to repair some of these sort of frayed relations that developed over the course of the Iran nuclear deal, which was very unpopular in the Arab world, particularly among Gulf allies like Saudi Arabia, and we want to refresh this relationship. They felt good about that. They thought that perhaps Senator Bob Corker, viewed as a more moderate Republican with deep foreign policy experience as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, might be the next Secretary of State. When the headlines started coming across about Rudy Giuliani or perhaps other individuals who have more controversial views, so to speak, and now Frank Gaffney, who has been called by the Southern Poverty Law Center an Islamophobe, that really sends a dangerous message, many Arab leaders say, because, look, relations are already in a tough place. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, they're very much central to the U.S. campaign against ISIS. And when you start insulting your allies and empowering people who have made it a policy to say anti-Muslim things publicly, it really is alienating, not only to the leaders themselves, but to the public that they have to deal with at home, because they have to deal with their own domestic politics. Also concerned that someone like Steve Bannon, Sheldon Adelson, who's on that transition team, because they have very, very pro-Israel beliefs, that they may not simply provide the kind of military aid and financial support to Israel that the United States has consistently said, and every presidential candidate and existing president have continued, but perhaps they might go a step farther and do something that is symbolically would really have an earthquake-like effect in terms of alienating Arab allies, which would be to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something that might be seen as symbolic to some. Arab diplomats are telling me they're very concerned about. We're really in uncharted territory. So whether it's Europe, whether it's Asia, whether it's the Middle East, there are so many questions. Who are the next cabinet members that Donald Trump is going to empower? Are they the kind of Republicans that many Arab leaders, European leaders, have deep relationships with because they've dealt with them on Capitol Hill? Or are these unknown entities? And whether it's the financial markets or foreign policy, the unknown, the unpredictable, is very unsettling.
And Margaret, finally, what about Europe's own populists, nationalists? The president coming into Berlin today, of course, they have their own movement there in France. People talking about Marine Le Pen even possibly ascending to power, possibly. In Europe, we've seen the Brexit. What's the impact of the Trump election on Europe's nationalists, populists, right wing?
Well, it's interesting because in so many ways, President Obama today, when he was speaking to the Greek people, touched on this, saying, look, this is not just about populist sentiment and movements at home, and I understand why people feel alienated and angry in America, and I see that here in Europe as well. But he pointed to it as sort of the darker side, that nativist sentiment, the tribalism, the us versus them mentality. And that's something that many European leaders, whether it's Angela Merkel in Germany, here in Greece, they have been concerned about. There is strong anti-immigrant sentiment, particularly in the wake of this refugee crisis that has sent in hundreds of thousands of people fleeing conflict in Syria to European shores. There's been a pushback, and they are in many ways raising concerns and warning that the empowerment of populist, nationalist, right-wing groups is a dangerous thing. And President Obama touched on that. Certainly in Germany, as I said, the chief diplomat there called Donald Trump, the president-elect of the United States, a preacher of hate.
Margaret, let me ask you, Obama was so popular when he was first elected in Europe. Is he still today? I mean, he's received a lot of criticism himself for leading from behind, maybe being too passive in foreign policy. How does Europe see him now as these transitions unfold?
Well, it's a divided Europe just like it's a divided America right now. I'm trying to sort of get at that divide in terms of the reaction to globalization, open borders. Certainly what happened with Brexit reflects some of the same frustrations that people felt back in the United States during this election, that somehow they're getting the short end of the stick with globalization. President Obama himself, among European leaders, tends to be quite popular. In many ways, he speaks the language they do in terms of alliances, international agreements. But there is actually very deep frustration that President Obama did not do more, particularly on the issue of Syria. The French feel very strongly about that, that they were sort of left at the altar, ready to go help the United States carry out airstrikes to take out the chemical weapons.
Margaret, we've got a hop. I appreciate your joining us there from Athens. Margaret Brennan with CBS News, traveling with the president. We're looking at Donald Trump and American foreign policy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Donald Trump's America First doctrine and what it may mean for the country and the world as President-elect Trump scrambles to put together a foreign policy team in Washington and President Obama makes his last big trip abroad. You can join us this hour. How do you see Donald Trump reshaping America's relations with the world? What's he inheriting from 70 years of post-World War II policy, from 8 years of Obama? And are you ready for a President Trump to say to old allies, pay up or you're on your own? Are you ready for Trump to warm up to Moscow, to tangle with China? Are we dismantling globalization? Is that a good idea? What do you see coming here on the foreign policy front in the age of Donald Trump? In his victory speech in New York early last week, Donald Trump spoke to the world of America First and of partnership.
I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, all people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict.
At the Republican National Convention in July in Cleveland, the message was more fierce.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo as long as we are led by politicians who will not put America first, then we can be assured that other nations will not treat America with respect, the respect that we deserve.
Then candidate, now president-elect, Donald Trump. The whole world is watching and listening, trying to figure out what is coming here. With us now from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you right here.
Great to be back, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from New York, Ruchir Sharma, chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, author of The Rise and Fall of Nations. Ruchir Sharma, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Michael, can we first go to the transition that is underway in Washington right now? Now, this is never simple. It's a huge job to put together a new administration. There are a lot of headlines, though, in the last couple of days about how there's turmoil in the Trump transition, particularly on perhaps the foreign policy front. What's going on there?
I'll say, Tom, you know, you get an overall feeling here that this is a group of people who did not expect to be in this position. The Trump team didn't seem maybe prepared for victory. And if they were, you know, there are some signs they didn't quite grasp the enormity of the task of simply kind of moving into the federal government. And so what you have had is organizational disarray, political infighting, dueling agendas. You also have what you might call a kind of immature political team around Trump, by which I mean, apart from his family members, advisors who are relatively new to his world, turfs that are kind of still being defined and people fighting with each other. And I think that the main story from yesterday, which I wrote about for Politico with my colleague Shane Goldmacher, was a realization that Trump, when it comes to foreign policy, is really going to take a very unconventional route, at least in his personnel. But personnel likely will dictate policy. And what I mean by that is that when Trump was elected, a lot of what you would call the sort of establishment, the foreign policy establishment in Washington, reacted with great dismay. A lot of these people opposed Trump, thought that he was, frankly, dangerous to be commander in chief. Many of these people had served in the George W. Bush administration, but were feeling a little hopeful. Maybe kind of by the time we got to the weekend, there was a sense that Trump might be putting in some sort of known quantity, temperate, moderate, somewhat centrist type figures in key national security jobs. Mike Rogers was leading his transition on intelligence. Rogers is liked by both Democrats and Republicans. He's a former longtime congressman who chaired the House Intelligence Committee from Michigan.
Republican.
There was talk that Kelly Ayotte, New Hampshire Republican senator, also a moderate who was defeated on Tuesday last week, might be Secretary of Defense. Steve Hadley, who had been George W. Bush's national security advisor and had a very centrist record and reputation, his name was floating around. And Bob Corker, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman, a very kind of cool-headed, calm, pretty middle-of-the-road guy. Well, what we learned yesterday was actually none of those people appear likely to be getting jobs. Mike Rogers, who was leading the intelligence side of the Trump transition, was essentially purged for his ties to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was sort of booted out of Trump world for reasons we can get into. And you've seen some new names floating who are people really, you know, on the fringe of the Washington foreign policy debate. They include Frank Gaffney, who is a longtime sort of a national security activist who has said that President Obama is a Muslim, once said that the Pentagon had a logo that secretly had Islamic undertones, that it was some kind of a subversive Islamic symbol that had infiltrated a Pentagon official, an official Pentagon logo. Rudy Giuliani, who has no formal diplomatic experience and is maybe a smart guy, but known for being kind of a hothead, according to many of his critics, now seems to be the front runner for Secretary of State, which is very upsetting to a lot of longtime diplomats. So we can talk more about all this, Tom, but the bottom line here is that those kind of Washington establishment center of the road people are now totally horrified. And many of them who had been debating whether they had an obligation to go and serve a president elect who they have little respect for now feel like they can't. And indeed, they're actually not welcome at all. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll stop, is that this maybe shouldn't be surprising. Trump ran against the establishment, said that the foreign policy elites with the gilded resumes and the New York Times op-eds, wrecked the world and wasted money and lives in the Middle East, and that he's going to do things very differently. So this is sort of what people voted for.
Donald Trump did not promise to be middle of the road, and now he's president-elect. Here was former Michigan Rep. Republican Mike Rogers, who was once considered the candidate to lead the CIA or become director of national intelligence.
booted from Trump's transition team yesterday, talking with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
I think there is some confusion going on about a chain of command coming out of New York. Hopefully they'll get that settled pretty soon. I think they're going to need to do it because as this clock ticks, all of these decisions become more important, and you have to make them sooner with a little more authority and a little more forward thinking to make sure that they don't bump into anything in the future.
Who's mainstream? Who's not? What's expected here? John Bolton, another name up for Secretary of State, very fierce on the Iraq war front and at the UN later. Rand Paul, Republican senator out of Kentucky, criticized both Giuliani and John Bolton on CNN yesterday. Here he's focusing on Bolton, who briefly served as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under George W. Bush and very much supported the Iraq war. Here's Rand Paul.
You want to have a diplomat in charge of diplomacy. You don't want a bomb thrower. And so, no, John Bolton's totally unfit to be Secretary of State.
That from Republican Senator Rand Paul. Ruchir Sharma, you've got a big theory of what's unfolding here. It's bigger than Donald Trump or the United States, perhaps. But what we'll get to that. But what do you see unfolding right now from your perch as a strategist at Morgan Stanley?
Well, I think that, these trends are really global in nature, which is that we have lived in a world which has become much more interconnected, globalized. That was the dominant theme which drove so many things between the 1980s and right up until the global financial crisis of 2008. But as I say in my book, which is that you can really split the world into BC and AC, BC being before crisis, AC being after crisis. And what we're seeing across the world here is
by crisis, you mean 2007, 2008, the recession?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. right. So yes. That's really, I think, where's like a generational shift in terms of what happened. And we are still seeing the consequences of that today. I mean, here's one statistic which sort of puts that in perspective, just to show you the power of this anti-establishment wave which is running through the world, which is a decade ago, 2 out of 3 incumbents who were running for re-election were getting re-elected.
Mm-hmm.
Over the past year, less than 1 out of 3 incumbents who have run for re-election have got re-elected.
Globally?
Globally.
Okay.
So, so we looked at the 30 largest democracies in the world, and this is what we are finding, that the approval ratings of the leaders are also at an all-time low. And every time there's a new leader who comes to power, there's new hope, and the approval ratings tend to jump. So that's a sort of global phenomenon that we have seen, a very strong anti-establishment wave that's running through the world today.
Michael, I mean, your first headline after Donald Trump's election was, "Trump victory provokes crises in foreign policy." Now, Donald Trump, maybe he wants that. He's been expressed extreme unhappiness with the globalization order and said he wants out or wants to maybe overthrow it. Is this crisis or is it opportunity?
Well, for Trump, I think it certainly is an opportunity. I think for much of the world, it is a crisis, although there are leaders and countries that share Trump's view that it's an opportunity. I mean, one man's crisis is another man's opportunity. So it depends
certainly
on
for
what
changing
you're talking
things. As we speak here, I'm getting news that the Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree today withdrawing Russia from the International Criminal Court. If there's been an order that you liked, it's changing. It's changing right now.
It's absolutely changing. And, I think fundamentally it's going to be an order in which America exerts less control, presides over, to the extent we still preside, a much reduced kind of global framework of alliances and structures and trade agreements. There's a massive infrastructure still there. NATO is not going to disappear overnight. Our trade relations around the world are not going to crumble overnight. But you're going to see American power recede in an intentional way. Trump's view after, generations of American presidents who thought that America should be an expansive global leader that spent a lot of money to maintain power and presence around the world and should be willing to shed blood if necessary to protect our values, not just our core national security interests. Trump is not interested in that, and he wants to save money, and he doesn't want to get tangled up in foreign conflicts where I think you can't explain the rationale in a bumper sticker, basically. And he's going to pick some new fights, including with China.
What's the difference, Michael, between President Obama's kind of leading from behind and reluctance to get enmeshed in foreign conflicts and Donald Trump's?
That's a good question, Tom. I think it's it's a matter of degree, at least. I think that Trump's is a more radical version. I think Obama's was to kind of, let's say, take our foot off the gas pedal or maybe tap the brake a little bit in mm-hmm. terms of America's involvement around the world. And Trump is going to slam on the brakes. Remember, President Obama surged our military presence in Afghanistan, intervened in Libya's civil war, has been moving military equipment to Eastern Europe to bolster NATO against potential Russian aggression. Although he mostly stayed out of Syria, we have had a program to covertly support Syrian rebels, and we tried to have a more explicit Pentagon training program to arm and train Syrian rebels to fight Bashar Assad, which fell apart partly because it was too difficult to pull off. President Obama has been pretty involved. He has stepped back a little bit. Trump, we can walk through it, is going to throw a lot of that stuff out the window right away.
We've got callers for the two of you and big ideas and big facts still to get to. Jim in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. First of all, it just really bothers me that you guys kind of act as though Trump is, preaching hate and rhetoric and anti-globalization and all this stuff. Yes, and the Morgan Stanley guy on there, he just acts as though that we can't tweak the trade deals. We're not talking about just completely withdrawing from the global market. You guys act as though that's what he wants to do. He doesn't want to overthrow it. He doesn't want out of it. He wants to tweak the trade deals.
Jim, be careful there. Donald Trump is very fierce against globalization. That's not us. That's Donald Trump. Again, we just played the tape. We just played the tape, Jim. Tweak, you use the word tweak, Jim, and it may be tweaks, but he's talked about tearing them up as well. I mean, do you think he wants to be isolationist, though, or do you see something else entirely, Jim?
Of course not. He's a CEO, man. Have you ever met a CEO?
Many, Jim, many.
That have never negotiated things in your life. And another thing, every one of you guys on there, mainstream media, we know that you guys are meeting with the Democratic Globalization Party. That's obvious.
Jim, that's absurd, my friend. But do you think that America will be better off if we pull back to an America First posture and let the structures that have been in place since World War II go? Are you ready to let NATO? Donald Trump said maybe it's obsolete. Do you agree, Jim?
We're going to negotiate with NATO. We're going to make it better because we've had idiots negotiating this stuff for us, lawyers up in Washington. Man, here's what happens. You ship 1,000 good factory jobs mm-hmm. overseas out of the U.S., you get 20 forklift jobs unloading containers. There's a big difference.
There's a bottom line right there. Jim, let us pick that up. Ruchir Sharma, the bottom line in all this, I think, in Donald Trump's promise to the country is we're going to bring jobs back, and we're going to do it by being more America First oriented in everything we do in our negotiation with the world. How does that work? You're at Morgan Stanley. Maybe Jim in Tennessee thinks you're part of a corrupt Wall Street. I don't know, but you're paid to be a strategist for people who think about the economy and not excluding the American economy. What about the Trump approach when it comes to jobs, Richard?
Yeah, I think that I wrote an op-ed about this last year, basically to say that that the American middle class is finally beginning to see some relief anyway, that their wages have been in decline for a long period of time. But from last year, as we got the data, that the wages have begun to increase. And here's, I think, going to be like the delicious irony here, which is that it's almost a bit like it reminds me of the 92 election when President Bush Sr. lost, and then the economy just sort of took off after that. There is some evidence for me here that finally, after a seven-year very weak economic recovery, economic growth is still okay, but wages are really beginning to pick up, and job and the unemployment rate is low. Even the broad measures of the unemployment rate, our data shows, is now at levels where typically the bargaining power shifts to the workers. So
will Donald Trump's approach keep that going?
Yeah, in terms of the fact that I'm not sure as to what he's going to do as yet. So I'm not willing to comment yet on what he's going to do because we haven't seen any specifics. And I think that what I do know from my experience from the world is that the way is that what people say on the campaign trail and how they govern can be extremely different. You know, like I've seen similar panic in other countries. I saw it in Brazil back in 2002 when like we thought that the entire Brazil was going to withdraw from the system and Lula got elected. He comes to power and he governs very differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to really reserve judgment on what he's going to do in power. But what I do feel about America are two points. One, that the American economy is a bit more solid than we think, and that we are finally, I mean, I know it's been a very dreary time for the average worker, but mm-hmm. we're finally beginning to see wages pick up. And two, that the decline of America has always been overstated, you know, which is that over the last few years, again, we are seeing that the troubles of the rest of the world, the other parts of the global economy, are even greater than what we have in America.
Richard
and I
Sherman,
think that that is something that's going
to
come through.
Stand by if you would in New York. It's great to have you right there. Chief Global Strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, Michael Crowley, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Please stand by. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump's America First philosophy and what it may mean for the country and the world as President-elect Trump scrambles to put together a foreign policy team in Washington and President Obama makes his last big trip abroad. Michael Crowley is with us, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Ruchir Sharma is with us, author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in a Post-Crisis World. And he means after the economic crisis of 2007-2008, he's Chief Global Strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Let's go back here and hear from Donald Trump talking about NATO, because President Obama's there right now, reassuring folks there. This is an interview with Bloomberg in March saying that he sees NATO as potentially outdated, obsolete.
I think NATO may be obsolete. And NATO was set up a long time ago, many, many years ago when things were different. Things are different now. We were a rich nation then. We had nothing but money. We had nothing but power and you know, far more than we have today in a true sense. And I think NATO, you have to really examine NATO. And it doesn't really help us. It's helping other countries.
Get real, get new, says President Trump, and the rest of the world really watching. You can join us this hour. How does America First or nationalism work in an interconnected world? Does it? Who's going to fill the ranks of Trump's foreign policy operation? Do you want Rudy Giuliani at the top? And how do you imagine the world according to Donald Trump? All kinds of different responses. A very important one, perhaps, from Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, who Trump was very hard on the campaign trail. The day after the election, she said she would work with Donald Trump on the basis of the values, she said, that Germany and the United States have in common. Here she is interpreted by Euronews.
Germany and America are bound together by values, she says. Democracy, freedom, respect of law and respect of people, regardless of their origin, the color of their skin, their religion, gender, sexual orientation, or their political beliefs. On the basis of these values, I'm offering to work closely with the future president of the United States, Donald Trump.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel there the day after the election. Michael Crowley, Donald Trump says American interests first. What about this raft of values? I say raft in a throwaway way. These are kind of central values to the U.S. At home and abroad for a long time that the German chancellor puts out there. Is Donald Trump signaling that he's ready to stand by those as well as, you know, the jobs bottom line?
Well, I don't think Donald Trump is going to say he doesn't share those values, and he has repeatedly insisted that, you know, his positions are consistent with those values. A lot of people don't see how the logic follows through, but, you know, I don't think he's going to concede that he doesn't support that kind of pluralism, but he's going to say there are all these exceptions and, well, we have to have borders and we can't let, you know, immigrants come in willy-nilly without knowing who they are. I mean, this is his language, not mine. But I think that, you know, Merkel, he and Merkel are going to have to work together. I mean, she may not like it. He may not say everything she wants him to say. She may not say much of what she wants him to say. But I think it's difficult to see how she can kind of shut him out or refuse to work with him. There are just too many shared interests. And, you know, you're already hearing this from the German government, you know, not Merkel's statements publicly, but German government, you know, conversations with journalists. They are not coming out guns blazing against Trump. They're saying they are very open-minded. They want to work with him. They think that this transatlantic relationship is really essential. I think there's going to have to be a partnership there.
Elizabeth in Needham, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I just want to know when Trump supporters, when we start taking what he says at face value. Your previous caller, you played a tape of Trump saying one thing and his supporter said, he's not really going to do that. When do you take what he says at face value? I think the best quote that I've heard is that people who did not support Trump took him literally and not seriously, and the people that support him took him seriously and not literally. Where do we draw the line of what we think he's really going to do and what he's not going to do? When do we take what he's saying as what he believes and stop trying to read between the lines?
Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. Ruchir Sharma, how about it? I mean, Trump had hot rhetoric on the campaign trail. He brought home a victory with that. And now you've got people who are attached to the status quo, not very happy, but is there not room for change here in how America relates to the world, Ruchir?
No, of course there is. So I think that, you know, we just have, I mean, I think that your caller's asking, I think that we have to look at what the first appointments are, I mean, in terms of the entire government. And I think there's a real debate on in terms of which side of the policy mix are we going to see. Are we going to see, in terms of more tax cuts and deregulation, which is the more traditional sort of Republican response to what's going on? Or are we going to see the other, you know, like the more trade warrior, anti-immigration kind of stance? And, you know, how's that balance going to be struck? So I think that we have to at least give this, till early next year in terms of knowing as to when or what exactly is going to be the governance style. As I said, that I just have seen too many elections across the world to know that what people say off the campaign trail and then what they say once when they get to office, there's a huge gap between those two things. And I have no idea as to whether we're going to see a repeat of that here, but that's something to keep in perspective before we pass any judgment.
But America First has not been an active slogan in this country, you know, for a long time, since in the years before World War II.
Yeah.
Now it's back. Now it's back in a different time, in the mouth of a different man. But how does that play out? I mean, you've written that we are already in a new age of deglobalization and that it is likely to last and last for a while. That is such a big, I think that's hard for people to get their minds around. Most adults today have never known a time when the world was becoming less global. It was always becoming more global. If that is already turning around, what does Trump's America First doctrine mean to that momentum? And what does that momentum mean to the U.S. and the world, Ruchir?
Yeah, no, I think that that's already playing out. But the interesting point is that it's not playing out only in America. So you have protectionist measures going up across the world. In fact, you know, like our data shows that it's basically countries such as India, Russia, China, where the protectionist measures have gone up even more than they've gone up in America in the recent past. The flow of immigrants has already slowed down. If you look at the flow of immigrants, whether it's from Mexico to the United States, or it's got to do from generally developing countries to developed countries, despite all the images that we see on television, those flows have also slowed down. The flow of capital between countries in terms of money flowing between countries has also slowed down. And I basically, like in the piece that you referred to, the New York Times op-ed that I wrote this weekend, what I say there is that this has happened in history before. We saw a huge wave of globalization between 1870 and 1914. And then between 1914 and 1950, we saw a big wave of deglobalization. And these patterns of decades of globalization followed by retreat have played out for many centuries that we know of.
And can that happen again? We were told globalization is now inevitable. President Obama continues in Europe this week to more or less say that. Can it really turn around? And if it does, what does it mean for the global economy, for the U.S. economy?
You know, I think that in terms of what it means to me, basically, is that you're bound to get higher prices, higher inflation, because I think that the pressure is going to be to try and restrict imports, to try and put more tariff barriers up. I think that's the general pressure everywhere. So I think that we've been so concerned about inflation, low inflation, deflation. I think that era is coming to an end. I think that we will see possibly slower growth across the world. And this is even worse for some of the developing countries, because look at what's happened even in the past couple of weeks. A lot of money has come back to America already. The dollar is surging. A lot of money is coming back to America because of this fear about, you know, what's going to happen to these other countries which have relied even more on globalization to try and grow. Some
is
of
this
the
good or
countries.
Bad for the U.S.? If you're putting America first in the Trump administration, slower growth is not what he's promised. What about the overall impact for the American economy, American workers?
Yeah, I think so. I think that unless it is offset by other policies, right? So I think that we have got like one of the biggest mistakes we tend to make is just get focused on one policy, which is that, okay, we're very focused on trade. Unless it's offset by other policies, you know, like small businesses are crying out for greater deregulation because there's far too much of pressure on that. I think that unless it's offset by other policies, it does mean slower growth, which is not that great. But as I said, I also think that wages are going to go up. You know, we've had this incredible skew in this economy where corporate profits have gone up substantially over the last 20, 30 years, and yet wages just haven't moved. And as I just said earlier, that trend to me is turning, that wages are now finally beginning to go up as the labor markets get a bit tight, and we have and corporate profits are going to be under pressure. So I think that that's another big shift I expect to see, which is that wages are going to go up one way or the other over the next few years.
But if you've got slower growth, you're saying, but yeah, higher wages, net-net, does that feel better to American workers?
Possibly not. I think, you know, like an era of deglobalization, I think that what we're going to find out is that globalization, despite all its ills, still was a better sort of environment compared to deglobalization. But I think that the only way that we have to come to that conclusion is after experiencing it. I mean, you know, one thing I find very fascinating in America today is that I look at some of the polls, and some of the polls mm-hmm. show that a lot of the young generation here are once again romanticizing about socialism, right? So in terms of mm-hmm. that, you know, that now I know, coming from a deeply socialist country, what it is, what
India.
The ill effects are of socialism as well. But mm-hmm. I think here we have forgotten what the downside of socialism is. So we're craving for some sort of an outcome like that. So this
what about
is
America first? What about that way?
Yeah, no, I think that in terms of that too, in terms it depends how you sort of play it out. As I said, that in, you know, that
But are you saying we've forgotten what that means when you get more yes. internally focused?
Yes, absolutely. We've forgotten what that means, because if you look at what's happening over the last decade, defense spending in America has come down. And America in general has been in retreat from the world, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. that you made a earlier distinction mm-hmm. that how is this like any different from what Obama is doing in terms of pulling back from the okay. world? So defense spending is coming down. But look at what's happening in other parts of the world. Defense spending is surging in places such as China, Russia, or in some former or even current allies of the United States, because I think that they're looking to fill the breach. They're looking to say, okay, you know, like in terms of we have to sort of become bigger regional superpowers, and in the absence of one big cop to rule the world, we got to sort of fill in the gap
is
out
here.
Is
that good, or does that take us back to nations going to war and maybe worlds?
Yeah, I think it definitely increases the potential for conflict. And I think that that's something that we have to sort of live with. It's very hard to forecast how that will break out or where it will break out, but it will. So I think that if history is any guide, we should expect in terms of higher inflation, higher wages, but possibly lower growth and increased potential for conflict across the world in this deglobalizing world, as I put it.
Here's the French president, François Hollande, talking with France 24 News yesterday about movements in many countries around the world, including the U.S. now, the U.K., far-right parties in France, talking about making toward global retreat. Here he is.
There is a temptation which is protectionist and isolationist in a number of countries. And that is happening not in just any country. In the United States, the number one economic power in the world, which is regarded as the continent which is drawing the greatest amount of benefits from globalization.
Not just any country, the U.S., which the French president says was the biggest beneficiary of globalization, headed the other way. Tom in Detroit, thank you for calling, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
You know what? Donald Trump is a danger to the world. I mean, you know, what do you say? What's the use of having nuclear weapons if you're not going to use them? I mean, come on, you know, that kind of mentality there, especially when you consider how fragile, you know, the conditions are with other countries in the United States. And I think, if anything, he's going to push countries and probably even some of our allies away from us with that kind of mentality. Because, I mean, the man is a bully, okay? What did he do? He ran a campaign based on hate and fear-mongering, and he just bullied through that. And, I mean, just like where he is now, he bullied his way to the presidency.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can bully 50 million voters into voting for you, but he talked tough and hot. That's for darn sure, and I appreciate your call, Tom. Michael Crowley, here we are. If the world is deglobalizing, if that's the way we're turning, and Donald Trump happy to roll with it, I mean, he's against globalism. How does that play out for the American economy, American power, standing, Michael?
Right. So I'll defer on the economy, but I will say that the analog to deglobalizing, again, it goes back to something I talked about earlier. It's withdrawing from this network of alliances that we have around the world that have preserved American security and, you know, preserved the security of large parts of the world.
I mean, we haven't withdrawn yet. So far, it's talk, right? Or
no? So far, it's talk, and we don't know for sure. But this is this is Trump's vision. In some places, it's more dramatic than others. He's not talking about scrapping the NATO alliance entirely. He's questioned its relevance. He's suggested that he may not honor some of its fundamental principles if other members don't pay their fair share. But conceptually,
if you don't honor fundamental principles, it gets pretty close to scrapping.
It does. But, you know, again, we're trying to divine what's mm-hmm. serious, what mm-hmm. does he mean, how far mm-hmm. will he take these things. But mm-hmm. the core principle behind it, again, Tom, again, and the analog is globalization. It's that we're too interwoven with the rest of the world. We're not getting enough out of these deals. Trump wants to basically be doing better deals with our allies around the world. We're protecting countries that he says aren't giving us enough in return. And he's talking about withdrawing and receding and being less active around the world, being less intertwined in regional rivalries and disputes. And I think that's the analog to stepping back from economic globalization. It's hunkering down at home, being very focused within our borders, not caring so much about what's happening around the world unless it has a very immediate and direct bearing in his analysis on us. And so that's happening on a parallel track in a security sense to the deglobalization in an economic sense.
Hunker down at home. Ruchir Sharma, in a word, can that work? Does that work in the 21st century?
Well, I think it's worked in the past. These cycles have, and history will repeat itself again.
Of course, the last time, the cycle you point out, led to isolationism, protectionism, and ultimately World War II, Ruchir.
Well, I think that, you know, as they say, that this old Russian proverb that ignore history and you lose an eye, and if you focus on it too much, you lose both eyes. So I would keep an eye out on history,
will,
but I wouldn't get obsessed with it.
Okay, Ruchir Sharma at Morgan Stanley, Michael Crowley at Political. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.